You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Millions of anti-war protesters worldwide rallied this weekend against the Bush administration's agenda to attack the people of Iraq. But how much of that protest was reported on by the network news, and was the coverage fair and unbiased? And what difference did it make, really, in the broad scheme of things? We spoke with two individuals who monitored the press coverage around this event, Damu Smith of Black Voices for Peace and Peter Hart of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. We asked them for an overall rating of the coverage of the dramatic rallies over the weekend. First, Peter Hart of FAIR.
I think there's two things you have to look at. You look at the day of the events, the coverage that day on TV and then the next day in the newspapers, obviously. And then you look at what kind of impact it has a day after that or 2 days after that. Is it seeping into sort of mainstream media consciousness? Is it going to fundamentally change how they operate? The day of, there are different things you could look at. CNN, I think, did a better job than, say, Fox News, which I would say was downright horrible in their coverage of the demonstrations. The New York Times wasn't bad. But when you look at the next day, you look at the Sunday shows. Those are the shows on the networks like Face the Nation, Meet the Press, Fox News Sunday. Those are the kinds of inside the beltway, agenda-setting shows that really sum up the important business of the week.
Mm-hmm.
And by Sunday, the protests were largely background noise. We had John McCain on two different shows criticizing protesters for being ignorant or foolish. You had Condoleezza Rice on two shows, Tom Ridge, General Wesley Clark. So by Sunday, you were almost back to media reality, where the protests that happened were dramatic, were exciting, were very visual and graphic, but in the end, the political impact is minimized when the media decides to move on and get back to their usual suspects, the people they go to when they want to talk about these kinds of things.
Damu, Black Voices for Peace has launched a media accountability campaign, and you've been scrutinizing the coverage around this peace movement in particular. Your assessment of both the print and electronic media coverage around this weekend's events?
Well, it was very interesting. I think I agree with Peter, that the Times coverage was generally good. It wasn't bad. Could have been better, but it was good. They got the numbers question okay, because indeed there were 400,000, 500,000 plus people out there in the streets of New York. What was interesting about the Washington Post, which is certainly not the national newspaper that the Times is, but it has national influence, not just a local paper. The Washington Post put the global protests on the front page, but it put the New York protests on page A22 and did not mention the correct numbers. And I saw that as a marginalization of the U.S. protests. And I think the political agenda there is to say, well, you know, everybody else around the world has these huge protests, you know, 1 to 3 million in Italy. They did in Rome, they got that right. The almost million people in London, and then they mentioned the others in other capitals. But the U.S. protests, I think, in the context of the whole story about the weekend, were largely marginalized in comparison to the European protest. And I think that's about trying to say the American people are still with Bush. You know, that is the point here. Really, not as many people in the United States, like in the European capitals, are against this war. I think that was an agenda there. I will say that I really monitored the media very closely yesterday and last night. And I have to say that on CNN and MSNBC, they were very affirming of this story. And in fact, CNN had a special story on the peace protests. They had a reporter on yesterday afternoon who came on at least six times. I counted the Latino sister who's on CNN. I forget mm-hmm. her name. Mm-hmm. She's pretty prominent there. And she gave a good characterization of the march. She was talking about the fact that it was a broad-based kind of event, working class people, mothers, grandmothers. So I thought that was good. And for them to really make this a point, make it a point to say that the peace movement has made a point here with the Bush administration globally. So I think we've made an impact in the media, as much as they want to continue to marginalize the U.S. aspect mm-hmm. of it.
Well, now, I heard observers and analysts say that there was some good that came out of this, and as much as
someone characterized the peace movement as a second superpower.
I heard that regularly yesterday. In fact, it was on several talk shows. So, and this went on.
Whether
all,
that's true or not remains to be seen.
Right, but the fact that they were affirming that was a recognition of the power of this movement. And what was very significant, on the news, the head representative of the European Union was quoted. He was acknowledging the global peace movement, and he was saying this was not just a young, you know, radical. This was the whole society. That footage got played several times on CNN and MSNBC.
It sounds as though we have two phenomena or two dynamics working here. What Peter referred to earlier is to sort of like the superficial flash in the pan kind of impact initially on the day of, but not having this message really seep into the public or the media consciousness. And on the other hand, Damu, you're saying that it's possible that some of this is actually making a difference and working its way into some of the news media, MSNBC and CNN perhaps. What about the electronic, not the electronic, but the wire services like the Associated Press and Reuters, which actually distributes the information to so many news operations nationwide and actually sets the tone? Either of you care to respond?
I've seen different things about AP reports. The thing to remember with AP reports, people that are searching them online, because you can find most of them, that they change throughout the day. So you did get some early reports that, you know, when you look at them late Friday or early Saturday morning, they look like they're severely undercounting the crowds in New York and things like that. By the end of the day, AP had kind of come around, and they'd really, I think, caught up with the magnitude of the story, much more so than, say, Fox News Channel, where they had a host on that said that, you know, the protesters are supposed to have a permit for 100,000 people, but there's nowhere near 100,000 people out there. And the reporter on the scene, who apparently was standing in front of the UN, said, oh, yeah, they're far, far from that much-touted figure of 100,000, which is a direct quote from a Fox News reporter. Anyone who was at the march knows that there's no chance that he was actually doing any kind of reporting whatsoever, because that's so far removed from the reality that people were feeling in New York streets that day.
And I actually was in New York, and I think that perhaps depending on where you were standing, you might have that inaccurate perception of what was going on. And I think that that was deliberate on the part of the police and the city to keep the protesters corralled and restrained in different areas so that you could never really get a full sense of the magnitude. However, if you were standing on the stage and looking down First Avenue, you could see the full scope and depth of that movement. Now, how important is it for those aerial shots to be actually transmitted into the living rooms of Americans to see the shots and the faces and the individuals that make up the peace movement into the actual, you know, homes of Americans? How powerful would that be? Why is it important that the media show that, Peter?
I think it gives us some sense of who is participating. We've talked a little bit about CNN, and I think by far they did a better job than Fox News or MSNBC. A host at Fox News said, and I quote him directly, "We always feel very reluctant to show these pictures of the anti-war protesters. It is unrepresentative of sentiment in America." That is their editorial position, and that's what watching Fox was like all afternoon. I drew the short straw here, and I watched, I think, 7 hours of Fox News Channel on Saturday when I got back. And that is exactly how you experienced Fox, that whatever is happening here is not important. Every time they cut to a protest story, they would end it by showing the Fox News poll that says 69% of Americans support war. So it always depends on how you set up these things and what sort of juxtaposition you create, whether you say that Saddam and the Iraqi regime are gloating about the turnout, which is something you heard from time to time, or whether the turnout is sort of ignored or the participants maligned as usual suspects.
Yes,
something you heard over and over again.
That's correct.
These are the ways that the protests are kind of spun in the mainstream media. Mm-hmm.
Well, it was interesting because our producer was watching the coverage as well, and he flipped a few channels up and saw where CNN had taken those same polls and interpreted the numbers exactly differently, the exact opposite of how MSNBC was, I'm sorry, how Fox News was actually portraying those numbers. But you could have drawn the even shorter straw and had to analyze the coverage of the New York Post, which I'm sitting here looking at the front page, which I never really included in any serious discussion about the media. But it takes itself quite seriously and purports to be a journalistic endeavor. And so they have a picture of the UN Security Council meeting on the front page of the Friday edition. And in the picture, the French and German foreign ministers' heads have been transposed with photos of weasels' heads. And the caption under this photo reads, "Weasels to hear new Iraq evidence." I mean, I was appalled at this. But is this par for the course with the New York Post?
Well, actually, since they're owned by the same company that owns Fox News Channel, Fox News has been running that term, and they actually have their reporters referring to the axis of weasels as if it's a thing that really exists. On Sunday, their anchor in D.C. was on the roundtable discussion they have on their Sunday program and called the French foreign minister a pretty boy. So you do see how it sort of infects the culture of all the journalism coming from Rupert Murdoch's empire, that these ridiculous things that you'll see in the New York Post filter all the way down to their cable channel, to their broadcast channel, and so forth. So it does have some kind of impact within the empire, the Murdoch empire.
Well, I think this takes the attitude of unilateralism and arrogance to a very high level. Because, you know, I've been watching the French bashing in the media, and you know, we haven't even talked about the talk shows, by the way, the radio talk show, the right wing talk shows around the country. This is really a big issue, bashing the French.
But I saw a lot of protesters carrying French flags at the demonstration in New York on Sunday.
Yes.
And waving them.
Yes, people are really, really happy that finally two great European powers, France and Germany, are taking a very positive and progressive stance in relationship to the Iraq-U.S. crisis, and that's really what it is. The U.S. has made it such a crisis.
Mm-hmm. And you were going to say that there's been a lot of French bashing in the media.
A lot of French bashing. Last night on Crossfire, the subject was, do we hate the French or something like that? I can't remember the exact term. And they actually had a Frenchman on, a French citizen on, talking about the issue. But the host was just criticizing France. And this, you know, the media has stuck on this one thing about reminding the U.S. public about how much the United States did for France in helping to liberate France from the Nazis, and how many deaths were incurred on the U.S. side in the liberation, as if to say that is an automatic reason as to why the French in this millennium must agree with something that is totally undetached with what happened in World War II. It's unrelated. You know, it's a different context, different situation. But this has become part of this really mean-spirited French, especially French bashing, but also German bashing by many elements of the media.
Mm-hmm. I guess my final question would be, overall, is there any hope that the peace movement will, in fact, make inroads into the American collective psyche or consciousness, given the role that the media seems to be playing even at this point in the movement?
Let me respond to that very quickly. I think this weekend was the greatest weekend for the peace movement to date over the past year. And the media could not ignore this story. They had to affirm and recognize us, even in some way they did it. In some aspects, in a twisted way. I think where we're still missing is on the Sunday talk shows. We are not invited to speak on those shows. You know, listen, the people who are organizing these peace marches are people like, you know, Leslie Kagan, myself, and a number of other people.
United for Peace and Justice.
United for Peace and Justice, International Answer. We haven't been invited to be on Meet the President. Yet we are mobilizing thousands of people in the
millions.
Streets of the millions of people. Mm-hmm. We have a right to be heard, and we have a right for our views to be heard and respected on these talk shows.
Well, you were on Nightline.
I was on Nightline. That's great. Been on a few others, but I mean, the morning talk shows, as Peter said, They are very agenda-setting shows. You know, they come on Sunday morning, all the business people and other mm-hmm. people are listening, watching. So that's our next fight. Black Voices for Peace has a media accountability campaign, as you said, and that's going to be our next frontier of battle. We want to work with folks on this together.
Now, at the same time, Damu, you and the other organizers, United for Peace and Justice, and you're part of that coalition, you cast this as, you know, the world says no to war. So isn't it appropriate for the media coverage to focus more on the global aspect of this?
I think it's appropriate for the media to focus on both. There is a strong anti-war movement in the United States that has grown by leaps and bounds, very broad-based, very multi- and intergenerational, and that has to be affirmed simultaneously with the tremendous global peace movement exploding throughout the country. Let's not try to do this marginalizing the U.S. peace movement as if to say when it comes to the time that Bush said he's going to go to war without the rest of the world, it was because the U.S. people supported him. Forget about what everybody else had to say.
Mm-hmm. Any final thoughts on your part, Peter?
Yeah, I think these are all great points. There is some momentum here. The New York Times had a story, I think, on Monday that referred to the power in the streets. It's a movement that the media can't really ignore at this point. They've done a pretty good job of it up to now, but it's getting to be impossible because it's affecting how the diplomacy is playing out. The other thing you do hear from time to time, you'll hear especially TV reporters wonder aloud whether the protests are falling on deaf ears. You'll hear them say something like that, or you'll hear a TV person say, "Is anyone listening to the protesters?" And besides the irony of it, I don't think they're joking, but in reality, it's up to the media to decide whether or not anyone's listening. If the media themselves want to listen and want to engage in a dialogue, then they can do that, and they play a very active role in that. It's something to remember. It's up to them to decide whether or not they want to put people on the air and have a free-ranging debate about whether or not we go to war. So when they ask, are the protests falling on deaf ears, those are their ears, and they need to take some responsibility in that regard.
Peter Hart of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting and Damu Smith of Black Voices for Peace. Tujane Fekal is an outspoken liberal politician in Jordan, the first woman ever to win a seat in Jordan's parliament. She was elected in 1993 after being harshly criticized by Islamists for defending women's rights in Jordan. While the United States, through the Middle East Partnership Initiative, is addressing democratization of the Arab world as a last priority behind winning the war on terrorism, disarming Iraq, and bringing the Arab-Israeli conflict to an end, Tujane Fekal spoke with Peace Watch correspondent Raphael Kraft on the influence the Iraqi and Israeli-Palestinian crises have on democracy, women's rights, and the rise of fundamentalism in the region. She began by talking about the Jordanian parliament, which was dissolved by King Abdullah in June 2001.
I don't see elections coming unless the other issues in the area are addressed. And I see that the elections are tied to the changes in the area because the United States knows that it is doing so much damage to the area and it intends to better its image by offering more democracy, more human rights, more civil society, which means, as they said, they will reshape the area. And it is a way of appeasing people and of putting part of the blame on the Arab leaderships, which are to blame for totally siding with America. It depends on what's happening in Iraq and what's happening in Palestine. Even the government, you know, said that, well, it was holding elections because of what was happening in the area. But now I think it's American pressure that pushes them into announcing elections without specifying a date. There should be elections according to our constitution. That ruling without a parliament is illegitimate rule. If this was the case, then why not specify a day for elections? And if the war breaks out, well, you could postpone it.
Mr. Powell did a speech at the American Heritage Foundation in December, and through this Middle East Partnership Initiative, he's proposing to enhance the capacities of the civil society. What do you think about that?
First, I will give you the reaction of our governments who always voice American policies and side with it and give it a big propaganda, attacking Colin Powell's speech because it included liberties, sort of democracy, and civil societies. even if you say it's an improvement of civil society status, it will pour into democracy. Look at the professional unions. It is one of the civil society organizations. Now the state is targeting it. It should be revived. If it is revived, it will turn political again. Women's unions, youth unions are being like hit at by the government all through the last decades, because if we have youth union, they're going to be politicized too. So for the Americans, no, they cannot address these issues without them pouring into politics, eventually into real democracy. The government knows it. That's why the government were furious when Colin Powell delivered that speech. But we, the opposition, we welcomed it. We analyzed it, and we were banned to publish our writings in Jordan.
But in the meantime, the women's issue is on the headlines of every newspaper. Here in Jordan, the parliament now has a quota of 6 women?
Yes, it's on the newspapers because the government run all these newspapers. But you talk to the opposition and they will say no to all kinds of quotas. Because, you know, what we want is a national parliament that will address national issues, and we want qualified people. We don't want to split the country into a cake that each eats a piece of it. To avoid addressing the political issues, turn it into a social issue. If it was true, why didn't the prime minister appoint 6 women ministers in her cabinet? He could choose them and pick them by hand, or highly corrupt if he wants to.
Mr. Powell is proposing $29 million, which is not much, to the Arab countries target those civil societies we've just been talking about. In the same time, the envelope for Jordan is much bigger than the other Arab states.
Because the Americans are not willing to pay any money in the area. They have come here to collect money. And, you know, they want some Arab state to pay for the war, which was easier in the Second Gulf War and not now. So the Americans, when they say $29 million, a very funny figure, are saying they are going to exert political change but not pay for it, which means now they are supporting a few regimes which are known as dictators and which are known as corrupt. So the Americans are going to withdraw all the support, or part of it at least, to allow for this democratization. But the budget that is, you know, temporarily assigned to Jordan, it shows their political interest in the area. By the time this interest is served, they will go back to the old story, and they will not pay as much as Iraq, for example, used to pay Jordan through either free oil or subsidized oil. So there is no money coming. And, you know, what the Americans will do is political pressure. And since they cannot pressure the people, on the contrary, they want to appease the people, so they're going to pressure the governments and the regimes.
You have been in the past accused of apostasy by some Islamist people. How do you see the evolution of Islam and fundamentalist Islam here in Jordan in the last 10 years?
When I was accused of apostasy, the state allied with the Islamists, and this is a fact not known to the West. They hit me harder even than the Islamists did. If it wasn't for the state's support, the Islamists would not have been able to harm me that much. And it was the state who prevented me and my husband from getting any chance to work within Jordan to hush us once and for good. But I stood up to the fundamentalists, aided by the liberal progressive powers in Jordan, leftists and liberal, all the progressive powers. And we minimized their power. We don't see anything that is Islamizing laws, for example, and uncovered the pact between state and Islamists. Jordan is becoming a very moderate country, and the Islamists have been forced into presenting much more moderate agendas and policies. You know, all these, you know, issues have encouraged fundamentalism to return, and much stronger than before. And the fundamentalists now are not willing to dig up their differences with us, which is social plus political. No, they want to ally with us, and they look at us very favorably. And I, the one whom they sentenced to death, they still know that my beliefs, religious belief, haven't changed. But they are the ones who are coming to us. So we cannot fight them anymore. We are forced to keep a blind eye on our ideological differences, though they are basic, because we are put in one boat. We have all to combat a corrupt government, a government that aggresses all our human rights, whether we're Islamists, liberals, or leftists. So I'm sorry to say, fundamentalism is gaining ground again, And this time, we are not that willing to combat it because we have to choose among the less evil, the fundamentalists who are emerging, and they criticize the Islamic Front and they criticize the Muslim Brotherhood as we do for allying with the state like and making deals under the carpet.
What is the behavior of the current king and government toward those new fundamentalist movement?
The only method it knows is hit hard. It's using the sword, the stick, which aggravates things, you know, raising enmity more and more. But as for the king, there is no policy which I could tell you, this is the policy of the king. I don't know the king. If I don't know him, who knows him? His government, his secret police, who keep telling him, everybody is against you and they're going to assassinate you. You know, this is the version that they give to every monarch to exceed their power. Keep him isolated. So we don't know him. No one can tell you what is the policies of the new king, while everybody can tell you what was the policies of King Hussein, because he was closer to the people. He would give and take, so and he would change policies according to what you know, the political view demanded.
Tujane Fekal, the first woman Jordanian parliamentarian, speaking with Peace Watch correspondent Raphael Kraft. Finally tonight, another piece from the radio satire group, the Christmas Coup Comedy Players at Pacifica Stations, KPFT in Houston and WBAI in New York.
Our war against terror is a contest of will. Our power is a triumph of will. To the Iraqi people the fear of God's power and the full force and might of the United States military, and we will destroy them. For their ongoing defiance of America, we will destroy them. For their utter contempt for God, we will destroy them. Our war against terror is a contest of will.
Deutschland ist nun erwacht.
Triumph of will.
Die Macht haben wir nun in Deutschland gewonnen.
California. America. California. America. Triumph and will.
Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Adil Hamad of KPFA, Aaron Glantz, and Keith Chalgion. Thanks to Pete Karek at RadioForAll.net and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producer, Sam Husseini. If you'd like to support this type of programming, we urge you to visit Pacifica.org and make a pledge through our secure online website. You can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send your feedback to us at peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.